Okay, well, believe it or not, we are on episode 3 of the series Site Selectors Are People Too. My name is Devin Hilsden Smith. We're going to start this off with a little bit of a teaser, a little bit of a pivot to this podcast that I think everybody's going to be pretty interested in hearing about. So here's what's great about relationships. My fiance, Caitlin, been together 8 years. She is also in the site selection industry. And after listening to the first episode, she had a brilliant idea, rooted in the fact that my travel schedule over the next couple of months is a little unbearable with the new puppy at home. Sorry, Caitlin. But given the fact that I'm going to have the opportunity to go and see so many communities and explore and talk to new people, why not have every once in a while an extra little episode, which is a story from the road? Literally, I'm going to pack this Blue Yeti mic up and take it on the road with me. I think it's going to be interesting to explore an interview format, what makes economic developers tick in each of their various communities, and hey, whenever there's going to be the odd site selector there as well, that could make for a fascinating addition. So once again, thanks, Caitlin, and just proof that great ideas and great results come from relationships. But let's turn to the topic of this third episode, bridging the gap. Bridging the gap. I keep referring to this relationship as being two sides of the same coin, right? But when one side of a coin can't see the other side, that creates this psychological divide that, when not properly managed, becomes detrimental. It creates tension. And this is true in any walk of life, right? But even more so when what we're talking about is something as difficult and intense as corporate site selection and economic development. So in the first episode and the second episode, we set the stage, right? We talked about the profession at large. Most of my listeners exist and operate within this profession, so that all should have made a lot of sense. I have actually started up a Facebook page, Site Selectors for People Too, as well as an actual podcast website that you can find within the Facebook page, or if you, I guess, were to look up Podbean, which is where I host this, and search Site Selectors People Too, you'll find it. That's where you're able to get a hold of me, right? I've heard from a number of folks already just by way of my relationships that, yeah, Devin, we get it. In the first episode, first of all, we didn't hear your birds, right? You stopped, we didn't hear your birds. Your second episode, you talked about how there was some sort of, you know, loud rain storm, apocalyptic noise outside. We didn't hear that either. So, I'm still trying to figure out what all you all can hear, right? But the first episode was a bit of a primer. Second one, we dug into what it's like for the individuals on either side of the coin as they're going about their daily work and trying to produce the results that are required of them. In this one, we're going to explore the disparities that are created just by nature of the work that we do. So we're going to dig into some of the conflict, and we're going to talk about how we address those disparities as well. So the first section of this episode, we're going to identify these disparities. First of all, I keep talking about how it's all about data and information. There is an asymmetry around information in this profession. Site selectors, we often have access to extensive databases. We rely on market reports, industry insights, information that we're receiving from our firms internally, as well as consistently striving to stay on top of market news, location-based news, but we're very focused on these databases and these sources. Right? It's a little sterile It's a little bit sterile because we're looking at it from a desktop analysis perspective. On the other side, economic developers, let's be real, and I experienced this, you likely struggle to match this level of information. It's weird to think about that somebody sitting in an office on the other side of the country may have more insights into the data about your community than you do. Plain and simple. But that's typically the quantitative information, the quantities, the labor rates, the miles of interstate highways and exits, and it's desktop analysis worthy. Now, can you get access to all of this? Yeah, but some of it, let me tell you this, something that's really interesting to me is the fact that and I've gone back and now that I have access to certain types of databases, I've gone back and filtered through my former location in Jeffersonville, Indiana. And it's fascinating to me how much more information, how much more informed I feel about that community from a data perspective than I ever was in that seat. And I remember we would have these discussions when I was an economic developer working in this community about these types of data. And the response that we typically came up with was, we know everything there is to know. Who knows our community better? But it's a different type of data. The quantitative is very hard for a localized economic development organization that doesn't have the financial power that potentially a large commercial real estate firm or a large legal firm or accounting firm might have access to. It's hard to recognize that there is so much more information out there. And so the side of this disparity where Site Selectors thrives on the quantitative side is having access to those extensive databases that economic developers may struggle to match. Now, here's what's critical. Economic developers, on the other hand, are experts on the qualitative side. The qualitative side, the qualities. And quantitative and qualitative are equal, typically. They're equal in a full-blown integrated analysis. Economic developers rely on local knowledge, relationships. They know what's going on day-to-day, minute-to-minute. They are able to better have their finger on the pulse of the community, which is something that Site Selectors in their ivory towers, in our ivory towers, that we are not privy to, right? And so we shouldn't see it as though Site Selectors have better access to information and economic developers have lesser access to information. It's simply that Site Selectors have better access to a certain type of information and economic developers have access to another type of information. And that's why, even though you have this asymmetry in information between the two sides of the coin, that's why it's so important that the relationships are there, folks. Because to be able to put together a true integrated analysis as to whether or not the widget factory belongs in X community, you can't rely on just quantitative, you can't just rely on qualitative, you have to marry the two up, and you have to look at everything from a full picture perspective. And so that requires that Site Selectors be fantastic at their profession, at their craft, have access to really solid information from a quantitative perspective. And it requires that economic developers are able to communicate. First of all, economic developers need to be able to understand, mine, analyze, and present their qualitative side of things properly to Site Selectors so that the overall picture is painted properly for those clients. Now, I'm hesitating here because there's the other side of things, and this is where the asymmetry really comes to bear. I just described that as information all flowing in the direction from data sources or economic developers to Site Selectors to create these models. Well, guess what? Economic developers are never going to be privy to those models. Plain and simple. So what I'm exploring here, kind of just stream of consciousness, is, again, this isn't solely a decision whether or not that client should be in that community. It's also a decision whether or not that community should go after that company. And when the information is typically only flowing one way, that right there poses a massive problem. How is it that a community can properly vet whether or not their market, whether or not certain industry trends, supply chain trends, environmental impact trends associated with the type of industry that the company operates within, how can that community vet whether or not it's a good fit? I think that's going to have to be a topic for a whole other episode of this podcast, but you can see right there, right? If the relationship between the site selector and the economic developer is strong and they understand the pressures that each one is under, you start to find maybe you can close that gap a bit. But typically, because of confidentiality and everything we've talked about, we find ourselves in a position where, yeah, I guess site selectors and the companies themselves are privy to a much better set of overall data than communities are. I don't know how that's addressed yet. So that's information asymmetry. The other disparity that we run into would be priorities and timelines. So site selectors, we are driven day in and day out by client demands. A client doesn't have time to mess around with, oh, somebody at that local economic development office was out that day, and therefore we can't get the information in time for your quarterly board meeting. Client demands are what drive the speed of this entire process, right? They have their own concerns and market forces that they have to operate within. And we become a derivative snowball rolling down the hill, trying to feed that information up to them. That information relates to speed of doing business, cost savings, incentives are a part of that, the ability to truly access their supply chains. And so the priorities and the timelines are driven typically by client demands. And that leads into sometimes, which I would consider a bit of a problem, the prioritization of short-term wins over long-term community impacts. Because if a client needs to be able to show to their board, so say an SVP level group that are working with the site selector need to be able to show to their board that the upfront capital outlay is going to be lower in these communities versus these communities. And oh, by the way, over the next 10 years, this is what it's going to look like from an ongoing OPEX, discounted cash flow model perspective. They've still invested and they've hired individuals in this community. And those impacts go so much farther out than typically what corporations are looking at, right? What Wall Street wants them to look at, what accounting firms are telling them they need to focus on. Now, on the other side of the table, when it comes to priorities and timelines, for economic developers, we did, in my last, two roles that I worked within in economic development, and you all should as well, there should be a focus on sustainable growth and community well-being. And yes, attracting new companies, the attraction of new companies is a critical, a foundational aspect to both sustainable growth and community well-being. But there's so much more you have to consider as well. Like I said in a previous episode, attraction is just one side of economic development. You need to be highly focused on the retention of your existing businesses, so making sure they're taken care of and they're not hurting because of matters that you're able to assist with. You also need to be focused on overall community well-being that comes by way of expansion efforts, right? You want your local companies to expand. That is one of the absolute best ways that you can grow your local economy and your regional economies for the retention of and expansion of existing businesses. But sustainable growth and community well-being, those go so far beyond just the numbers and the discounted cash flow models and the OPEX and the CAPEX that an attraction or an expansion or retention project is putting in front of you. It also comes down to making sure the infrastructure is there, that the ecosystem, folks, that the ecosystem is in place so that this brand new company coming to town or the expansion of an existing company does not overly tax your existing resources. You have to look at it from the perspective of the school systems, of roads and utilities, and gosh, even down to, you know, childcare. Is there enough quality childcare in the region for those individuals that need to go and work in the factory, making a good living wage, right? But they're going to work in the factory and they've got shifts that they have to be there for, right? And what if those shifts are taking up the entire day? What if you're on first or second shift and there is a disparity again between when maybe the schools are able to look after your children and help them grow versus when the schools are shut down for the day and your kiddo still needs somewhere that they could be taken care of? So there's a lot of different factors involved in sustainable growth and community well-being. And kind of sort of related to what I said about site selectors, about prioritizing short-term wins over long-term community impact. Listen, I've been there. Economic developers, I mean, you get judged on the headlines sometimes, a lot of the times. Is that right? No. Does it showcase that you're an excellent professional? Yeah. But you have to be able to balance those immediate wins of headlines with the long-term benefits of more strategic thinking. And that could be challenging. And so the priorities between site selectors and economic developers as you're going through the process and the timelines, they are also a disparity in this profession. And finally, the third area that I wanted to touch on here is, we're going to keep going back to this, right? Because it's such an integral part of the profession, but there's a level of disparity when it comes to confidentiality versus transparency on the two sides of the coin, right? Site selectors must maintain client confidentiality, not only from a legal perspective, but also because if something gets out there and that something gets leaked through the, you know, the rumor mill and it gets out to one of their competitors and it's a really tight margin industry with a fierce competition, a leak within confidentiality can be devastating to a company. It can upset a projected future decade of growth because they weren't able to enter the market in a new way like they were expecting. And so site selectors are hellbent on maintaining client confidentiality. We also have to withhold information about competing sites. Now that gets difficult because economic developers, rightly so, continuously ask, how far behind potentially are we compared to other locations? And what they're really asking is, what can we do to be better to make sure that we can position ourselves to win this thing? And as a site selector, although you have to maintain confidentiality because you need to protect what other communities have told you, and you protect anything and everything you can about your client and their project, there is a benefit to being transparent to some degree about where a community fits within the overall competition. Because you want communities to, I've been there as an economic developer. You put forth your best, right? And there might be ways for you to get more creative, but why would you give away the farm if what you've already put in front of somebody is good enough, right? It's about a negotiating position. And so when an economic developer is always going to start in a position to give themselves some wiggle room for negotiations, how then can, as a site selector, how can you communicate the position they're in compared to other communities without divulging confidential information. You can sanitize, you can take it from a much higher level, but the more details you can provide, the better that community can be when they go back to the drawing board and go, you know what? We're still within our margin of acceptability here, right? We can still push this a little bit harder when it comes to either incentives or helping to fund new training programs or building out new roads. We can still kind of get there. But if they don't ever get that feedback to have those proper conversations, those really hard conversations, then again, the end result is not going to be the best that possibly could be. When it comes to confidentiality and transparency from the economic developer side, again, you need to offer up that transparency to build trust. But that's a struggle when site selectors are continuously, and rightfully so, but continuously tight-lipped about details. And that starts to then put you in a position where you feel like, well, if you're not going to show yours, why would I show mine? And then once again, the overall end product, the overall result or decision that is made that will impact a community and a company for one, two, three, however many decades to come, have you really found the truth in the matter? Have you found order within the chaos? And so the disparity when it comes to confidentiality and transparency can have snowball effects that truly, that have a true consequential impact on the future. So there's information asymmetry. There's disparities with priorities and timelines. There's disparities and consequences with confidentiality and transparency. There's so much more to go through, right? But for the purpose and for the sake of me not rambling on as I'm known to do, we're going to go ahead and stop it there for a moment. We're going to take a break. We come back, we're going to explore how these disparities can potentially be addressed in a deeper manner. See you soon. Hey! So we're back and we're going to go ahead and do our best to tackle at a high level how we address some of these disparities. We're going to go through communication strategies, data sharing and access, and aligning, in a broader sense of the term, incentives, right? So let's start off with what I think is the most fundamental way to address disparities, which is the communication strategy. The first thing that is critical is instead of it always being a fire drill and a hurry up and wait, there need to be regular check-ins established. There need to be regular check-ins established throughout the life cycle of a project. It's not that hard to schedule regular updates between site selectors and economic developers, right? Who is it that's carrying the torch on this? It depends on the site selector, depends on the economic developer, depends on the project, right? But having regularly scheduled updates, even if those updates are, hey, there is no update, it keeps everybody on the same page, even if that page has a lot of redactions. Right? But it keeps everybody on the same page. And it forces both sides to continuously think about, okay, this is where we were last time we talked. What sort of updates can I share? And if I don't have updates, what is it that I can do to start to move or to continue to move the needle on this project? On these update calls or Teams meetings or what have you, maybe it's just written updates, right? Maybe it's just a promise to each other that, hey, every second Friday, we are going to trade written updates as to what's going on, right? Economic developer might have to say, hey, here's the deal. We've put this site in front of another prospect. Just want to let you know there's some competition in the field. Site selector might say, hey, here's the deal. The client is really interested in a certain data point that we gave them, and the project is being delayed a little bit because they want an opportunity to review, right? That's helpful because most economic developers have monthly board meetings where they have to go in and give project updates. And at least when I was in my last role, if a project hadn't given me an update in 2-3 months, I would downgrade it from an active project to an inactive project, which meant that you're getting less attention from us and we were focused on others. So there's regular check-ins. And that's from the perspective and within the actual process of working a project. The other communication strategy is collaborating potentially by way of workshops. It's the relationship side of things. So you can have collaborative workshops where you have joint sessions between site selectors and economic developers to brainstorm solutions, right, that may arise from specific projects or might arise from things that are going on in the world of economic development. You know, there's, and this is one of the reasons why I'm such a fan of these conferences that are hosted, you know, almost every quarter, where site selectors and economic developers have opportunities to get together. It's a very low financial impact for a very high return on investment, so long as the conference is structured properly to have those open dialogues, right? What we're trying to do is we're trying to break down silos, and we're trying to foster understanding between the site selection world and the world of economic development. And if you're only ever communicating when it comes to projects, or, you know, you're sending out your typical blasts about the mayor's golf scramble, which, by the way, folks, I'm not going to read. If I don't live in your community, I'm very sorry. I don't care. It's a big deal, right, for your community. But we'll talk about proper email and communication strategies, maybe in another podcast. But for the sake of this one, if you're only communicating in those ways and in those isolated kind of fire drills, how do you ever create a better relationship that is going to result in better impacts and decisions at the end of the day? So one other thing, and I've hinted at this, how I offer postmortem reports and how I do my best to take phone calls and go into communities whenever I can. I'm unique in the sense that I do prioritize that interaction, that relationship. I'm not saying that others don't, right? It's just that I'm so new to this that I'm not yet fully inundated by just the onslaught of communications. And I think as we continue with this podcast and I continue to get more and more busy, it's going to be interesting for us to continue to explore that theme. My purported devotion to always being available versus when I get so busy and I'm not able to focus on that anymore, it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves, right? And either in the comments that you provide, you know, on the website or on the Facebook page, or just, you know, pick up the phone and call me or send me an email. Folks, you know, I those of you that know me know I don't take myself very seriously, right? It's hard to take yourself seriously when you have a face for podcasting, right? But you are never going to offend me by sending me an email and saying, hey, here's the deal. You remember a couple of years ago when you were so focused on doing better by connecting the two sides? Well, guess what? You suck at this point. You're not going to offend me. You're going to make me realize. You're going to make me realize that maybe I've slipped or that I need to reevaluate strategies for communication. So anyways, that's the first part of addressing disparities, communication strategies. Related, but separate, is a second area, data sharing and access. Economic developers, back to the disparities on information, you need to find cost-effective ways to invest in data analytics tools. Because you're doing yourselves no favors by not understanding how to put together a discounted cash flow analysis or how to analyze the numbers behind supply chain shifts, or how to analyze the impacts of potential additional unionization efforts in your community, right? Take some time. And I think something I'm going to do here is I'm going to try to find a way to put out a resource for some really good sources that you can get into. But take some time, spend some money, potentially instead of, and I'm very sorry to my friends that are publishers, but maybe instead of spending a couple thousand on an ad in a print publication, maybe you take that money, you invest in some data analytics tools. That way, you're able to narrow the gap on the quantitative side between what the site selectors know about you or think that they know about you and what you know about yourselves. you know, from a localized perspective, you have a really fantastic resource. And I highly recommend that you find ways to, in a meaningful manner, collaborate with your universities and research institutions that have their roots in your community, but also have that firepower and those skill sets to analyze what's going on from a different perspective. Now, site selectors, when it comes to data sharing and access, again, confidentiality is key, right? But you can still share aggregated insights without compromising client confidentiality. And I know that takes time, but I focused on doing this and I learn a lot about myself and about my process by going through this procedure, either during the life cycle of the project or after, and trying to figure out where I could have done things better. And guess what? When I can aggregate my insights and my findings, typically at that point, I could share it out with the communities that competed. So that then helps them to get better at doing what they need to do for the next projects that you're going to be looking at their communities for. It's a win-win. Again, it's a win-win. And site selectors, we also need to probably focus in on advocating for open data policies. Not only internally with our clients, but also with economic developers. Because we're in a really good position to use our voices and our bully pulpits, if you will, to push that advocacy effort. Open data policies being aggregation through research institutions, universities, being our one-to-one communications with communities that competed for projects, talking to our clients and trying to help them understand why it's so critical, as so long as we don't violate any confidentiality matters, but maybe open up the door for some additional communication. We're in a really good position because then we're gatekeepers between the two sides. So data sharing and access, very short topic there, but economic developers, invest in some data analytics tools, utilize your universities and your research institutions. Site selectors, let's find better ways to share aggregated insights, right? And let's advocate. Let's go ahead and advocate for open data policies to the extent that we can. The third main topic here in addressing disparities is going to be on that aligning incentives topic. And I said incentives from a broader perspective because I'm not just talking about tax credits and grants, right? I'm talking about incentives, both dollar level incentives as well as kind of subjective level incentives. So, you know, how is it that economic developers are able to take care of a client once they come to town and ensure that they have the level of attention that's necessary for them to be successful? But two different areas I want to focus in on for this addressing disparities topic, bridging this gap, right? Number one is incentive structures. Economic developers, typically at the state level, also at the local level, you have your go-to toolkits. And so when a site selector comes to you with a project that represents, we're going to make up some numbers here, $200 million of investment, 500 jobs paying $32 an hour in a manufacturing intensive industry that just so happens to be targeted right for that state or locality, you're going to run it through your cost-benefit analysis to determine what your return on investment is going to be. And you're going to look at your existing toolkit. You're going to look at your job creation tax credits. You're going to look at your capital investment tax credits. You're going to look at your training grants. You're going to look at the local level, your tax abatements, your infrastructure improvements, how you can get control of the site and maybe do a little bit of site work in advance, right? You're always going to go back to your toolkits because without better information from site selectors, you do what you're used to doing until you get feedback that says that you need to do things differently. And so it's not your fault. It's none of our faults, right? None of this is. It's just a reality of the profession. But if you always default to your standard toolkits, I guarantee you out of the other states and communities out there, there's going to be others that have had that wake-up call and gone, it's a great place to start from, but we need to listen to this project and what their specific needs are a little better and try to find some better creative solutions for them to show that we care and that we're going to be strong partners. And so the structures themselves, let's always try to explore win-win incentives, right? Win-win solutions. Economic developers, that means being a little more creative, right? Making it a little more personalized, a little more bespoke to the project itself. Site selectors, it's going to require having harder conversations with our clients to explain that this community is where you need to be from every other perspective, but guess what? They might not have come in at the highest level of incentives, but if you look at the overall 10, 20-year discounted cash flow model, it's not that big of a deal. And so let's stop pushing. They're doing the best they can, right? Because the worst thing that we can do is to require a community to go above and beyond what they're comfortable with or that they should put on the table. And at the end of the day, we've become the client's project has become a drain on the community. No company wants that. No company wants to be that issue in the community, right? We're trying to find a way to be good corporate citizens, but at a cost-effective rate. So win-win. And we're going to dig into this one. There's going to be a two-part series on incentives. And my colleagues in the industry are not going to appreciate, I don't think, my willingness to talk about incentives from a different perspective, but there needs to be, within incentive structures, there needs to be some transparency. There needs to be some realization around how site selectors are compensated. We need to be able to tie site selector success to community outcomes, not necessarily site selector success to the amount of incentives procured. And I'm going to leave it at that because we're going to really dig into this later on. For those of you, of my colleagues in the industry that are hearing this going, you son of a... I'm sorry. You know that I don't have a filter. And this is something that I've been passionate about for a long time. There is a significant role for taxation and incentives analyses and incentives procurement. But we're going to dig into that. So that's a little teaser. The other way that we can align incentives is through taking a look at a better long-term vision. Let's encourage site selectors and economic developers to consider legacy impacts of projects instead of just that short-term band-aid incentive win. And economic developers, you need to, when you're curating and crafting your incentives, you need to emphasize sustainable growth, not just trying to get the headlines, right? So that's a way, because incentive negotiations are always going to be one of the most tension-ridden aspects of our profession, where you're going to find a lot of disparities between priorities on either side. But I think there's a way to, at a higher level, bridge that gap. So we're going to take our second and final break here. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about some real life stories, as I like to do. It's going to be a shorter one because I always try to keep these episodes to about 45 minutes and we've got about 7 minutes left. But as always, let's have a little fun. Let's talk about some real world stuff. And just as a reminder, anything that I talk about has been highly sanitized, and quite frankly, I've completely messed around with the facts of the situation, but the overall lessons are still there. So, talk to you soon. Okay, we're back. So, in the interest of time, we're going to tell one success story about overcoming disparities, and we're going to talk about one story. We're going to share one story where continuing to rely on the siloed approach and not trying to bridge the gap resulted in some really bad results. So first one was a success story. And because it was a success story, I don't mind actually sharing who it was that I was dealing with, and I don't think they would mind either. When I was at my local development authority, we had the opportunity to revitalize the rail system, the short line rail system within the park itself, so that we could bring in a whole different diversified set of industry. as compared to what we had already brought in over the past decade, 15 years. And so the nice thing here was that I randomly got a call, cold call, from a gentleman by the name of Garrett, who worked for a firm called Omnitrax, a short line holding company of railroads based out of Denver, Colorado. Fantastic firm. They own and operate, I think, as of today, 20, 25 short line railroads, typically embedded within industrial parks and ports around the country and in Canada. And they had been doing their own desktop research and had some interest in talking to us. So I don't know, for those of you that have never been through the formation of a new railroad, I'm just going to put it bluntly, it is difficult. It is difficult. There are so many considerations that have to be put in place, especially when you have a situation like we did, where we as the development authority owned all the land that had not yet been sold, and we also owned the railroad assets. But for a proper short line to operate, they really needed to be able to own those assets themselves on our land. And so we recognized very quickly, because Omnitrax also has an industrial development affiliate, Bro Real Estate, we at the Development Authority recognized very quickly that this was something we needed to find a way to get a yes on. And listen, we talked before about how disparities can present themselves by way of information asymmetry, priorities, timelines, confidentiality, transparency. We faced all of that in our negotiations. We all knew that we wanted to get to a yes, but how were we going to get there? And I'll tell you what, as soon as we got under NDA, which is a wonderful tool for bridging that confidentiality issue, as soon as we got under NDA and we could start really having the deep conversations about why, Omnitrax, why is it that you need to own the railroad? It was always our perspective that we were just going to lease it out. Oh, it's because if you own it, you're going to spend more money on maintenance and upkeep. And oh, liability flows to you guys instead of us now, because, you know, rail traffic is, you know, moving some things that if not dealt with properly can be hazardous, right? Okay. Yeah. You convinced us. All right, good. Check that box. Well, how are we going to structure the actual financial side of things? Because at the end of the day, this is what we're expecting. This is what you're expecting. There seems to be a gap here. And we talked through it. And we had the conversation. And it wasn't as easy as a 30-minute chat. It was multiple conversations with multiple individuals across multiple disciplines over the course of months trying to solve these issues. And at the end of the day, we are able to strike a very curated, customized agreement whereby Omnitrax formed in partnership, not in partnership, sorry, it wasn't a true legal partnership, but in partnership from a, hey, we're partners, shake hands, we're in this together type deal. But Omnitrax and the Development Authority were able to find the right solution that made sense for both of them. I mentioned in a previous episode that the best deals are those where both sides feel a little uncomfortable walking away from it. This is the epitome of that. Both sides felt a little uncomfortable, but I can tell you what, the River Ridge Railroad is in full operation today. I'm actually sitting here at my desk staring at a HO scale model locomotive engine that is painted in the colors, which I'm very proud of. I will always be proud of. I'm also a bit of a rail nerd, so, you know, I know that's a weird thing to say, but they're operational today and everybody is doing well because we found a solution to confidentiality by putting in place an NDA very early on, and we talked to each other as partners, not from legal sense, partners trying to find the right end solution for everybody. So that's an example of a success story. I've also, in my career, been involved in a lot of stories that were not success. The results were not successful, right? Especially back when I was the regulatory ombudsman for the state of Indiana. And The story I'm going to share briefly here is this was pre-mega project days, right? These days, most economic developers see billion-dollar plus projects come across their desks, right, on a monthly basis. There's just a lot of capital out there, and there's a lot of supply chain shifts. But this was, you know, back in pre-2020 when projects that were proposing multi-billion dollars of investment were, holy crap, like, we need to put everybody and their mother on this project, right? And I say everybody and their mother, my mother can recite this project verbatim to me to this day. This project, multi-billion dollar investment, huge emerging industry potential, actually had the ability to impact the environment, even though it was a heavy industrial project, impact the environment for the better because of what they were doing. But in order to get to that point, and my role in all this was they did need to get in and get some serious level environmental permitting completed. This was a fail, an example of a fail, because the two sides, even though our side was so excited about the numbers, we didn't feel the love from the other side when it came to trying to be partners on this thing. The communication was not there, unless it was a fire drill. The overall siloing of efforts was abundant. And so day in and day out, we constantly faced tension. The company saying, hey, we need to get our Title V major for PSD air permit issued like tomorrow. Otherwise, you're done. For those of you that don't understand a word I just said, effectively, they're asking us to shortcut a 270-day permitting process, which required a lot of air emissions modeling with some of the most powerful computers in the industry, public access periods, public comment periods. They thought that because they had the governor's cell phone number, that they could just skip everything. First of all, that should have been a red flag. The fact that they didn't want to, or they didn't think that they needed to comply with environmental permitting. And so the interactions between the state and this company were terrible at best. We consistently tried to make them feel special because we didn't want to lose the project. But when it came down to brass tacks, when they were always putting fire drills in front of us, and then whenever we came up with solutions that were common sense, that worked for both the environmental regulators as well as the company, but it required the company to, you know, hold your horses for a bit and let's go through the process, they continuously then just pulled their political cards. Guess what? It's been almost a decade since then, and they haven't broken ground. When the two sides of the coin treat each other as though they are opposite sides and adversarial, or it's continuously a negotiation or a trying to leverage one against the other, you're never going to find the solution that makes sense. And I'll tell you what, the state of Indiana was ready to bend over backwards, and we did everything we could. And hey, did we make mistakes? Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not infallible. My God, am I not. But the company's approach, by the way, they didn't have a site selector for whatever that's worth. But the company's approach was such that they continued to push and push and push in areas where there was no wiggle room. And at the end of the day, I don't even know if they're still in existence. I'm going to have to look it up. So should have flipped it so that we started with the negative and ended with the positive. But the positive overall tone here is, listen, there are ways to bridge the gap between the disparities that face economic developers and site selectors. We just have to be a little more intentional about it, right? So I'm going to go ahead and end episode 3 on that note. Reach out if you have any questions or if you have any comments. I would love to weave them into future episodes. I know this thing is brand new, but I really think there's going to be a fascinating dialogue and some really good stuff for us to uncover as we continue to talk. Because you know what? As I always say, at the end of the day, Not only are economic developers site selectors, or, yeah, there we go, it's been a long day. Not only are economic developers people, but site selectors are people too. Cheers, y'all. Just a heads up, views expressed in this podcast are solely my own and are not attributable to any employers, whether past or present. Thank you.